Because of Elaine Freed's absence, we have an alternative program today that we're thrilled to present. And the scholar's name is Keith Fessenden. He is a Colorado native and grew up on the Western Slope as well as in northeastern Utah. He has a long-held love of Western history, and his research varies widely. He researches and publishes on everything from Gilsonite industry of the Uinta Basin to the Mormon War of 1838 and a Catholic parish in Denver. Today, he will be presenting a paper entitled Colorado's First Tourist Railroads, Incline Railroads, which I know you'll find fascinating. Please help me welcome Keith.
Well, first, let me point out that around the late 1800s, tourism became a mainstay of incline railroads nationally. A website maintained by the Metropolitan Postcard Club of Colorado, of New York City, states this rather well. Incline railroads, as interest in natural tourism increased in the 1890s, so did the attempts of businessmen to find new attractions the public would pay for. The view from mountaintops had long made them popular destinations, but were usually only accessible to the hardiest of travelers. Incline or small gauge railroads solved this problem, allowing the feeblest of tourists to enjoy a grand view for a price. Summit houses offered rooms, meals, or other amenities increased their popularity. These railroads were difficult to maintain due to the difficult terrain they were built on, and most disappeared over the years. Now the success, which is the Mount Manitou Park Incline Railroad, 1908 to 1990. The Mount Manitou Park Incline Railroad, also known as the Mount Manitou Incline Railroad, also known as the Mount Manitou Scenic Incline, was located in Manitou Springs, Colorado. And it was the first of the cable incline tourist railroads to be built in Colorado. And so far, it's also had the longest lifespan. An article in the Colorado Springs Gazette, November 4, 1907, precipitous road to climb Mount Manitou states, down the face of Mount Manitou there runs a perpendicular scar. It is 4 yards wide and a mile long and is visible almost as far as the Front Range itself. It is along this cut, up and down a grade of 44%, that strong cables and well-built cars will carry hundreds of passengers the coming summer, unfolding to them unrivaled scenic beauties. And you can see the scar in this early photograph. And I should also point out that current political correctness states the Mount Manitou incline is actually on Rocky Mountain, with Mount Manitou being a mountain top or two away. This 1 mile scar was created by the Hydroelectric Company in 1904 while building part of the water system of Colorado Springs. The scar was the site of an incline railroad built to haul sections of pipe up Mount Manitou for a pipeline from Ruston Park to the top of Mount Manitou, whence it headed down the mountain to the generating plant of the Pikes Peak Hydroelectric Company near the base of the Pikes Peak Cog Road. The Hydro's construction cars ran up and down the incline, taking 45 men to work and hauling 500,000 pounds of steel pipe up the slope. I should point out that other than the Royal Gorge, this is probably the most prolific of the incline railroads in Colorado as far as postcards and photographs. Charles W. Stiff of Colorado Springs looked at this scar and got the idea to convert the pipe hauling incline into a tourist carrying incline, cable incline. He interested several others, including a Denver dentist, formerly of Colorado Springs, and a civil engineer, Claude McKesson. In October 1907, the Manitou Incline Railway Company was incorporated for $220,000 to build a new scenic incline railway upon the bed of the old. And in Brumback of Denver was president, Charles W. Stiff, Colorado Springs, vice president, E.L. Whitney, Colorado Springs, secretary, N.T. Brumback, Denver, treasurer, and Claude McKesson, Colorado Springs, was superintendent. By November 1907, more than 3,000 feet of the old railway had been pulled and regraded. 1,200 feet of new track had been laid, and Claude McKesson, superintendent, was confident the incline would be operating by June 1908. The Mount Manitou incline began operation with its own power plant at the top of Mount Manitou. The plant generated sufficient electricity to operate the railroad. Initially, the railroad was designed using a two-cable design with the strain equally divided between them. Each cable was capable of raising and lowering the cars by itself. Later, when the engineering news mentioned the railroad, this had changed. The railway now used 114 wire cable with a test load of 90,000 pounds to raise and lower the two 30-passenger cars. The cars had a maximum weight of 9,000 pounds. There were also two fixed safety cables which passed through automatic grips and clutches on each car. The railroad was designed originally to use two tracks on the upper half and one track on the lower. And this is the Summit House at the top of Mount Manitou. How many of you have been up there? Again, well, this is probably 90% of the room this time. As Claude McKesson had predicted in November 1907, on the 28th of June 1908, the incline began operation. Initially, the fare was a dollar, but business started out slow. The fare was lowered to 50 cents, and the railroad did a brisk business on the 4th of July weekend. The original cars were open to the elements, so each car held waterproof ponchos, one per seat. Later cars corrected this with waterproof curtains. Initially, each seat held three adults, with the cars capable of holding 33 passengers, including the conductor. The incline proved to be a draw, even in the off-season. It's interesting, when you look at the back of the cards, some of the statistics change periodically. So. And you can see the three rails. And then they widened into four to pass. For years, just prior to reaching the top, the upward car was stopped and a photograph taken of the passengers. This photograph was then sold in postcard-sized prints for 25 cents as a souvenir to the passengers. And these are a couple of those. But one of the most popular selling postcard views of passengers at the upper station was this one, which was taken, I don't know the date that the 22, there were the governors of 22 states went to the top of the incline, other than it was in the 1920s. At the top, the passengers found trails, burros to ride, a lunchroom, and picnic tables. The photo shop, scenic wonders, a wonderful view of Pikes Peak, and a fantastic view of Manitou Springs, Colorado Springs, and Kansas. And this view is really impressive. The Manitou Springs incline ran until 1990, when a mudslide wiped out a portion of the incline. The owners decided not to rebuild. And I don't know, I'd heard that they'd been losing money for several years. But. And today, the scar, my daughters run up and down that all the time, and I tell them they're crazy. But. This is a photograph that's at DPL, and it's also here at their library. And when you look at the original photograph, this view is, for lack of a better term, just awesome. The reproduction does not do it justice. So if you're ever down there and get a chance to look at it, I'd recommend it, because it's just really nice. The elevation at the base was 6,590 feet. The length of the incline was approximately 1.5 miles. The average grade was 45%, with a 13% minimum grade and a maximum grade of 65%. This gave it an average of 1 foot of rise for every 2.5 feet of distance. The Red Mountain Incline, or also called Red Peak, depending upon the time frame, it was started in approximately 1912 and ran until roughly 1922. This is the failure. Around 1910, two entrepreneurs, J.H. Griffith, the operator of a curio store in Manitou Springs, and B.M. Starks, general manager of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, headquartered in Louisville, Kentucky, conceived the idea of building an incline on Red Mountain at Manitou Springs, Colorado, to compete with the Mount Manitou incline. This copycat, so to speak, was also repeated in Golden, where there also was a couple inclines. The development of the incline moved slowly, but by sometime in 1911, they and other promoters, including Manitou banker D.H. Rupp, son-in-law of Jerome Wheeler of Aspen fame, had hired local real estate men to buy up the property along the right-of-way they'd not yet acquired. When the real estate agents advised the promoters that in order for them to get the desired right-of-way, the real estate men were requiring 51% ownership in the stock of the company, Mr. Starks left the company. The other incorporators proceeded to sell $15,000 of stock to local residents. Since the purchase of the property they wanted was blocked, they moved the site of the lower terminal westward a few hundred feet and used a different route for the incline. This is from a brochure on the incline. And I've got other copies of this, but the best pictures I found were at this website, so you should visit it. It's really quite excellent. In 1912, when Mr. Rupp was the company's president, the annual passes for the incline listed the Scenic Railway Company, Red Mountain Incline. By 1913, the company was in receivership. It is not clear if the incline operated at all until 1919, when the Red Mountain Scenic Railway Company was incorporated by Arthur D. Kenton, W.F. and P.J.E. Robertson at $50,000. It appears they built a restaurant complete with music and dancing at the top. But even this attraction failed to draw crowds. Business was no better off than before. Now, I've talked to people who tell me that one of the reasons this incline didn't do so well was because it was so steep it scared the bejesus out of everybody that rode it. And a couple of these inclines were like this, but I can look at this, and when you look at close-ups of these cars, you're going, you want me to sit in that frail little thing going up this steep hill? I can see where that happened. On November 2nd, 1920, the business was sold twice, with the ultimate buyer being Maurice Mendel of Denver. For $25,000, he received the Incline Railroad, the buildings, land, and a number of lots near the incline's tracks. He transferred these assets to the Red Peak Scenic Railway Company. And the way my pronunciation is today, you guys can read it a lot better than I can. So. This is the car at the top. And actually, the scariest picture on an incline is one of the Mount Morrison incline, where they show somebody standing on the car and it's on a hill like this. So it's. Now this one, also above Mount Manitou, or above Manitou Springs, had its own ad. It says Red Mountain Incline, with mountain abbreviated if you. This Red Peak Scenic Incline Company operated the incline for two more years, then ceased operation. In 1925, creditors obtained a $25,000 judgment, and in 1927, the line was scrapped. And this is a view from the top here. And next is the footnote. It's the Eagle Nest Incline Railway. It was also referred to as a mountain elevator. And this is the only picture I found of it. And I wasn't really aware of this one until I started doing research, and this one popped up. I don't know a lot about it. I'm still getting into it. But what it did, It was built in the late 1940s. I want to say 1948, but I could be wrong. And it went up to the Eagle's Nest overview at Seven Falls. It's readily apparent that if you've ever climbed those stairs, that it's not everyone can make that climb, nor would everyone want to. So it was designed to allow everyone to go up for an additional nominal fee. The back of this card reads the Eagle Nest Observation Point and Incline Railway at Seven Falls in South Cheyenne Canyon, Colorado Springs, Colorado. And you get, as you know from this observation point, you get a magnificent view of the falls. In the early 1980s, this was taken out. And I don't know for sure. Someone told me it was because of insurance costs. But currently, there's a mountain elevator which was blasted 14 stories straight up through solid granite, safely transporting those who wish to the Eagle's Nest observation platform. That's from their website. So it was replaced by a modern elevator. And now you know a little bit about three of the seven tourist cable inclines in Colorado. I normally go way over on my talks, so I designed this one to be a touch short. So I know you're hungry. If you have any corrections to anything I've said today or additional information or photographs, brochures, anything like that, feel free to get a hold of me, because it's a growing area, and it's funny, you don't find anything and then it kind of, you start finding more and more. So thank you.
Mr. Tesla is joining us today to discuss his time in Colorado Springs and the experiments he conducted. Please prepare for an electrifying performance. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Mr. Nikola Tesla. Mr. Tesla, we've all been looking forward to this. I'm so eager to meet you.
I appreciate the opportunity to return to your fine village. I first came here on May 17, 1899. And before I speak to you about the various experiments and reasons I came here, let me preface my remarks with something about my earlier days in the context of why I was here. I must thank the lady who introduced me. In 1928, I made a statement that I saw society moving ahead in a far more humane and proportionate way with the advancement of the talents of women, but I did not realize it meant shaking hands with women. I was not born here in the United States, but rather in a small town in Croatia in 1856. My father was an Orthodox priest, and he looked forward to me following in the same career, but I was far more interested in science, in how everything worked, and I was fascinated from the earliest age as to why pumps worked, why wheels went around. And that expanded for the rest of my life to the point where I not only wanted to know how all our daily operations conducted themselves, but also how did this world work? How did our solar system work? How did this cosmos in which we live operate? And it was a motivating factor for me then to study. I went to the gymnasium in a small town near my own hometown. Later, I went to the Polytechnic Institute, and then finally, my final studies were at the university in Prague. By then, the development of electricity was going on, and I was fascinated by that. I was able to work at several places in Europe in some connection either with the telephone or the telegraph. I became familiar with the work that Mr. Edison had done. But early on, I realized that there were better ways with electricity. I was committed to study. During my years at school, I found it best if I could read 15 to 16 hours a day. After I had come to this country in 1884, I worked for Mr. Edison for a short time, but we did not work well together. And I then was able to convince Mr. Westinghouse that the idea of alternating current, basically using a rotating magnetic field, was the best way to make use of this new source that we had of electricity. This came to fulfillment when we developed the generators and all the equipment at Niagara Falls and used alternating current, and very quickly the entire city of Buffalo, New York had all the electricity it needed from what we had developed there. But I was interested also in doing more research, and particularly in wireless telegraphy. And a friend of mine, Mr. Curtis, who had been the attorney for Mr. Westinghouse and myself, and who had worked on the patents and the legal affairs that we ran into, had moved here to Colorado Springs for health reasons. And so he wrote to me and said, this would be an ideal place for you to come and to test out some of the experiments you've been talking about. And I can guarantee you two things. One, you can have all the land you want. And secondly, you can have all the electricity you want because I'm on the board of the Colorado Springs Electric Company. And so I came here on May 17th, 1899. Mr. Curtis met me at the Denver and Rio Grande Station in back of the Antlers Hotel. But my room, the rooms I had were at the Alta Vista Hotel in the 200 block of Cascade. And I spent my entire time, that was where my suite was. I was in suite 207. I insisted there because I couldn't imagine riding elevators. They're very dangerous. And so I had a beautiful view of Pike's Peak. And I mentioned at that time that I looked forward to sending a message from Pike's Peak to Paris. Mr. Curtis also took me for lunch on a number of occasions to the El Paso Club, and I enjoyed that. The land that I was able to use was on East Pike's Peak, very close to the Colorado School for the Deaf and Blind, and a little bit west of the Union Printers' home. And it was there that I developed my lab. I was fortunate to have a man named Mr. Dozier, who was a carpenter here in town, and was very familiar with the development of your town, and particularly of the recent discovery of gold in the mountains near Pike's Peak. And we got along fine, and he helped me develop my laboratory, and he also helped me develop some receiving stations around this city. But your high altitude, the wonderful amount of sun here, was not only pleasing to me personally, but was ideal for the experiments. And it may be unusual to you to think that how committed, rather, the people were at that time for communication to go through wires. Every railroad was built, had a telephone poles along it, and the telegraph was hooked up to that. In some cases, telephone lines, that if you wanted to call someone from here to Denver, there had to be a line. But I was convinced, with my understanding of the potency of the earth and of what I had experimented with in atmospheric conditions, that we can send messages and we can send pictures and music in a wireless way. I had done an experiment in New York where I had a pool about the size of this room, and we had built small little boats on it and put engines in them, but they were wired so that they could receive a message in a wireless way, and I could control those boats. I also predicted that the day would come when the development of wireless communication would enable a person, any person in the world, to have a small instrument, maybe 2 inches by 3 inches, and you could speak to anyone else in the world. Well, you can imagine the criticism I received for that, because you had to have wires hooking people up. But I saw, in terms of the research I was doing here, the potential of the Earth itself being a conductor of electricity, and by having proper receiving stations, we can not only convey messages, but we can transfer energy. I felt that after my experience at Niagara Falls, that we had three potent sources of energy that could change what we were doing at that time in around 1900, where we were burning so much wood and coal, and this new source we had of oil. Because with water, the water power from Niagara Falls, with wind, which people had actually been using for centuries, but we hadn't developed it that well, and then with the energy that simply came from the sun, that we would never have to burn these again. I spoke to one of my financiers, Mr. J.P. Morgan, one time, and asked him for approximately $100,000 to do research on how we can use the energy from the sun to develop all the type of electricity that we needed here on Earth. And he refused me because he said, I can't put a meter on it. How am I going to make any money? This was different how I thought. I was thinking as a scientist. I was not necessarily a good businessman. And he saw it simply as one way to make, if you can't make money off of it, then don't do it. I didn't see it that way. I saw this, the potential of the communication that came with wireless technology and the ability to transfer energy all around the world as a way for the human race to develop in a way it had never done before, that we would get rid of war, that particularly the role of women would improve, that we would have a far, far more humane society, and through some of the research I did, I felt that we could get rid of war as a means of settling disputes. Two other experiments I conducted here in Colorado Springs at my laboratory on East Pikes Peak Avenue. One evening I was there working, and on my receiver I got some definite signals that almost seemed logical. And the only conclusion I could make was that these were coming from Mars or Venus or someplace in outer space. Well, the reporter from the Gazette thought this was rather crazy, but my understanding was that if you look at even our solar system, let alone our galaxy, who says we're the only intelligent beings around? I assured people I could send a message to Mars 10 times more stronger than was necessary. If we get a response, then we can decide what to do with that. The other experiment I conducted was with my associate, Mr. Zito, who was a technician working with me. And one evening, I'd set up my equipment so that we would basically have lightning in my laboratory. And I thought everything was ready. I told him I would give him a signal as to when to throw the switch, and he did it. And for a few moments, there was lightning all through that laboratory. And basically, I had lightning in my hand. Within a few moments, though, it all stopped. And I asked him, I said, why did you throw the switch back? He said, I didn't. What happened is we had burned out the generator with the Colorado Springs Electric Company. And it made the officials there angry enough that they, from then on, would charge me for the amount of electricity. But my experiment worked, and came to realize again what the potential of the conductivity of the earth and also of the atmosphere could provide us for the development and the humanization of our society. Briefly, those are the experiments. I thoroughly enjoyed my time here. I love the lightning storms. I was fairly sensitive in terms of knowing what was going on. I could hear when there was a storm, say, up around Longmont. I could hear a train 30 to 40 miles away. And it was wonderful doing that here in your community. And I'm pleased to be back. And I'd like right now to stop, and I welcome, I have about 10 minutes, and if you have questions or comments, I'd be interested in hearing them. Yes, sir.
Do you get any prizes or make any money out of it?
Did I make any money out of it? Out of all my work, yes, at one point I did. Mr. Westinghouse paid me $1 million, but I did not live a life of poverty, and I also put my money back into my research consistently, whether it was here or back in New York where I set up another lab. I was not good at the business angle of my work. I depended upon Mr. Morgan and other financiers to underwrite me, but at some point that began to dry up. And certainly in my last years, I did not have that much money.
Why not a Nobel?
Well, Mr. Edison and I were nominated one time for a Nobel Prize, but it never turned out to be that way. And so in reality, I didn't get it. Yes, ma'am.
Of all the things that you experimented on and worked on, what do you consider to be the greatest or the one that you are most dear to?
She's asked, what do I consider of all the experiments and so forth and inventions I made, what's the most significant and important? I would say in terms of society, the alternating current. You have it here today. It runs machines. I worked on developing the machines that have, because I understood the rotating magnetic field and what that meant and how different that was from what Mr. Edison tried to do. And the direct current is simply too expensive. Financially, it was good for him, but it was not necessarily good for our entire society. And I felt that with alternating current and also using sources such as wind and the sun and the water, everyone in the world could have all whatever energy and communication they would want. Yes, ma'am.
For many years, I was a teacher here in Colorado Springs, and you used to invite the kids to your museum, and you did great things with them, had them hair stand on their, stand up, and I think it was probably the best thing I ever took them, and I wondered how you got doing that, inviting the children down.
Inviting these children so far?
Yeah, like our schools to come in and you did this great show for them.
Well, when I was running the laboratory here in the months that I was in Colorado Springs, there were certain young people that I enjoyed having come. I did put up a few signs of danger because I did not want to risk someone coming in and playing with it and being electrocuted. I also put up a sign that said, "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here." Yes, in the back.
Yes, why did you leave Colorado Springs?
Well, I had an opportunity to set up another lab on Long Island in New York, and it was financed, and that was one of the reasons. I also had a lot of my friends that were there, and I was interested in that. Although I thoroughly, when I left here, I thoroughly intended to come back to Colorado Springs because I loved the atmosphere and the wide open spaces where I could conduct these experiments that I was interested in doing. Yes, sir.
I heard a story once that the sheriff, though, repossessed a lot of your lab stuff here after you had left for payment of debts or something like that.
So he heard a story that the sheriff took over the lab and so forth. That's true. But I heard that someone basically paid a few dollars for the lumber that was there, and that was about all they got out of it. So, yes, ma'am.
Did you patent any of your experiments or inventions?
Yes, I patented a number of them. When Mr. Marconi developed a radio, he used, I believe, 17 of my patents to develop the radio. And he accomplished essentially what I was looking at doing also, namely sending a wireless form of message over a great distance. And but to do that, he had to use the inventions I had developed. Yes?
Did you invent a machine that is called an oscillator in New York that you turned it on and it shook the city?
Asked whether I had a machine that an oscillator that sent vibrations. Yes, I did. And basically, there's vibrations going on in the earth. There are vibrations going on all over. And with radio, you have to hit the right wavelength and so forth to get your message. This one time, I had it so tuned in to a building in New York that the building collapsed. The police were not happy with that. But you're right. Yes, that did happen. Yes?
When you blew out the generator, what effect did it have on the city?
Well, everybody's lights went out, and there was no electricity for the rest of the city.
How long did it take to restore the lights?
Well, I think that they had several generators, so they were able to switch over to a couple that weren't burned out and then got the electricity back. I don't know exactly how long that took, though.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Yes?
Did you invent alternating current?
Did I invent alternating current? I think that's a fair thing to say. What happened is, again, I saw that by using alternating current, you could also run machines and motors in a way that you could not do with direct current. So I think that's a fair description that I invented. I can't say I invented it. I discovered that, and that if it used in that way, it was a far more effective means of providing electricity, not only to homes, but to businesses and industries than with direct current. The direct current, if you had been in New York in the 1880s, every mile there had to be another power station in order to move the electricity along, whereas with alternating current, we didn't have to do that. Yes, sir.
Can you describe your experiment, the last one you did in the city, the one where you're shooting a beam of energy at Pike's Peak? What happened there?
What happened when I shot a beam up to Pike's Peak?
Yes.
I don't remember shooting a beam up to Pike's Peak. I sent wireless messages around to the receiving stations we had, and I was looking forward at some point to sending a message from the top of Pike's Peak to Paris, but that never came about. on my part, but later on, with the inventions and research I had done, you can do that today.
So did the city bill you for burning out the generators?
Well, I think that was the reason that they tried to repossess that laboratory and get some money back from it. But that's what happened there. And maybe Mr. Curtis came through too. He had a little bit of money. Well, I've agreed to stop here at 2:00. I appreciate it. I understand there will be a 15-minute break, and you can take a little relaxation. And I will be glad to stay here for 15 minutes if someone has other questions or comments. And I thoroughly enjoy being back in your fine village. Thank you very much.